Hello and welcome to the Fergan. My name is Dan and I'm here to try and make sense of these turbulent times from a heathen perspective. Visit fergan.com for links, merchandise, an archive of past episodes and information on how you can help keep this podcast running. That's fyrgen.com. Hello once again, friends, and welcome to the Fergan. This episode of the podcast, I'm joined by a very special guest, someone who I've been planning to have as a guest on the Fergan for quite a while now. His name is Thorbecht, and he is an ambassador for Theodish belief, and he is the König of the Winland Ríki. Thorbecht is an author who's written several wonderful books, not all of which I've read myself, but the ones that I do own, I reference quite regularly. And we're here to find out about Theodish belief in general and about Thorbecht's own background and about the group that he specifically leads. And Theodish belief, for those of you who don't know, is one of the heathen factions in the world which focuses on Anglo-Saxon reconstruction, really, in quite a strict way, which a lot of the other heathen factions in the world don't do. And there are some advantages to this, I believe, and Thorbecht will be able to inform us of what the reasoning for how Theodish belief does things the way that it does. I am here to learn as much as you listeners are, because there is a lot to understand about Theodish belief, and there's no better man to explain this to us at this point in time. So Thorbecht, it's really good to be speaking to you, and thank you for joining me, and how are you?
Well, Dan, thank you so much for having me on the Fergan. I've listened to about half of your podcast episodes so far, and have tremendously enjoyed them.
Oh, thank you very much. It's high praise indeed. I do find that Thorbecht is quite supportive of my musical endeavours online as well, Walkensman. I believe that he does occasionally enjoy a song or two of mine, so it's good to be making that connection and being able to express my appreciation for what he does as well.
I wanted to compliment you on the audiobook for Fire in the White Stone that came out recently. I enjoyed that quite much and have shared that with other Theodsmen. And I also intend to begin listening to that and make that part of like a nighttime bedtime story for my children.
Oh, wow. That's thank you very much. That's wonderful to hear. I'm really glad to. It's I often say to people, I actually have no idea how my short story is really received because I've not had much feedback on it. So to have feedback from someone such as yourself that's as positive as that, you know, is quite heartwarming. But anyway, we're not here to talk about me or Fire in the White Stone in this episode. So Thorbecht, Theodish belief. Could you introduce the listeners? Could you explain to the listener what Theodish belief is about, what your position is within the wider realm of Theodish belief? Yeah, just give us a bit of a kind of overview.
Sure. So for those who might be less familiar with heathenry, I understand you have a broad audience. Theodish belief is a rekindling of the many-god troth that was held by our Anglo-Saxon heathen forelders before the coming of Christianity. We worship many of the gods who are still known in the English language today, such as Woden, the god that Wednesday is named after, Thunr, the god that Thursday is named after, the goddess Eastra, from whence the Christians get the name Easter. As Theodsmen, we gather throughout the year to hold the holy tides and to keep them according to the Anglo-Saxon calendar and how our Germanic continental ancestors kept them. Theodish belief itself and the Theodish Ríki, which is the fellowship to which most Theodsmen belong, was founded by a man named Garman Lord in Watertown, New York, way back in 1976, after he had a vision in which he beheld the therewithness of Woden. So listeners who've listened to episode 5 of your podcast, Divine Encounters, might already have an understanding of what all that entails. And then over the past half century, Theodsmen have begun to establish fellowships, which we call Theods, not just in New York, but all the way down the East Coast to Virginia, into the American Midwest, up into Canada and as far away as Tasmania, Australia.
But nothing in Europe, right?
Not yet.
No.
So
okay,
we would certainly like to establish a hole in England at some point. I know when I went to my wife and I went to England back in, I believe, 2011 for a honeymoon. And we were there, we went to the village, the ancestral village from whence my family comes from. And there was a hill overlooking the village and with a patch of woods on top. We went up there, and at the very top of the hill, there was a lightning-struck oak tree. And we immediately, you know, held a feigning, which is what they'd been called, the rites of worship to the god Thunor in the Old English tongue. And to do that there in the homeland, it was quite an experience. And it's something that I would like to see done more often, not just simply myself going to England to hold feignings and to hold the holy tides, but I've been quite excited, and the Daidsmen in general have been quite excited to see that in the past 10 years, Anglo-Saxon heathenry and expressions of it have really begun to take root there in the old country. And I certainly think the UK would be ripe for a Thetis fellowship, and the Wheel and the Reacher would certainly be open to fostering one.
Okay, yeah, great. I mean, I can imagine that must have been quite an experience for you. You obviously have a strong connection to England, to the ancestral homeland, and to your ancestors from here. Otherwise, you wouldn't be rekindling their traditions quite as faithfully as you do. There are groups, of course, in England, there are heathen groups who have aspects of Thetism. There are there certainly are groups who insist upon calling the gods by their Anglo-Saxon names, using the Anglo-Saxon terms. There are other groups, the probably the most well-established one would be the Edenic Rite, who tend to go with the Norse names, just because I don't think it's so much a rejection of the Anglo-Saxon tradition. It's more that's what people tend to be most familiar with because of popular culture, because we grow up learning about the Vikings, but not so much about the Anglo-Saxons. You know, I can speak from my own experience there, where I remember doing modules at school in history about the Vikings, but not about the Anglo-Saxons. And, you know, to this day, that's only become more of a problem, in my view, with the popularity of the TV show Vikings and bands like Wardruna, who, you know, of course, they're bringing a lot of positive attention, particularly Wardruna, to heathenry overall. But people who are coming to heathenry through those cultural expressions are seeing heathenry through a Norse lens. So there's less of an interest in, you know, I mean, in England, we even have people putting on festivals and you know, weekenders and things that are specifically Viking themed. You'll never find an Anglo-Saxon themed festival over here, which, you know, is one of the things that I've always lamented. And it's actually one of the driving forces behind Walkensman, my dark folk project, is to try and express the heathen spirit in a somewhat similar way to bands like Wardruna, but in a much more English way. Anyway, thank you very much for that explanation, Thorbecht. I hope that gives people a good enough view of Thetish belief. And it is quite a fascinating area of heathenry to look into. So I would implore people to look further into it, because these guys, Thorbecht and the other Thetsmen, they are very faithful indeed. You know, there really is no half-assing it with you guys. So I have great respect and admiration for that. And, you know, the books that Thorbecht has written certainly speak to that faithfulness that you have. So you...
Actually, could I comment on...
Yeah, please.
You made a mention that there are a number of heathen fellowships there in the UK who have been inspired by Thetish works. Perhaps they've read some of our writings by Garmin Clawford or Alfred Clawford or even myself. And, you know, they picked up on a bit of Thetish through, a bit of Thetish tradition or custom. And, you know, I kind of introduced what Thetish belief is to those less familiar with heathenry. But to those more familiar with heathenry, there are a couple clarifying points that, you know, I'd be remiss if I didn't point out. And one is that This is a common misnomer in Nau Taili heathendom, that Thetish belief is simply a synonym for contemporary Anglo-Saxon heathenry. And it's not. Thetish belief is the truth of a particular people, that being the folkdom or the tribal society known as the Winland Richa, or as it's more commonly called these days, at least since the 2000s or the aughts, the Thetish Richa. We do indeed. We publish a great deal of what we rediscover. You've referred to our earnestness in reconstructing the troth of our forelders and to practicing it as close as we can to how these rites were held and to the worldview that was held at the time of our ancestors. And that's indeed true. And we share these things oftentimes freely, or we publish them in works that are readily available. But it's important to also realize that because Thetish belief is the belief of the Thetish Richa, right? It's less of a religious denomination than it is a tribal identity to be Thetish. It's not simply a set of creeds that one could ascribe to, although there are beliefs in Thetish belief that people can certainly ascribe to, and I think that they would do well to. Nor is it simply a collection of practices that one can adopt, although we certainly encourage those to build off our successes and Thetish practices that we've developed, or ancestral ancient practices that we've recovered. Those belong to all of heathendom, and we encourage people to adopt those. So I think that's fantastic, but it's important to realize that to be a Thetesman is to belong to the tribal society of the Thetish Richa, or to belong to a Thet that was sprung from the Winland Richa and is still enthused with it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you for clarifying that. And I certainly wasn't insinuating that just because someone is using the Anglo-Saxon names for the gods and goddesses that they themselves are a Thetesman.
We think it's wonderful. We think it's wonderful. And then when we see, so there's a lot of other terms that Thetesmen, there's certain terms that are anachronistic that Thetesmen have coined even. And we have seen those disseminated throughout Nau Taili heathendom, and a number of particular practices that were at one time unique to Thetesmen we've seen shared as well. And we're always excited to see that. It's great. We've been at this now for close to half a century. You know, Thetish belief has been, when you reconstruct the religion of your four elders, there's a great deal of experimentation. You know, you engage in research, and then you have to put the pieces together, and then you have to put it into practice, and then see how well it works, and then maybe take it back out of practice for a while and retool it or correct it. And it's been, there's that old adage that a rising tide raises all ships in the harbor. And so the fact that, you know, we in the Thetish Richa don't have to keep reinventing the wheel is a great benefit to us. But if other Nau Taili heathens can learn from some of our lore and discoveries, the discoveries of the ancient heathen religion that is our common heritage, if they can learn from those discoveries that we've made and carry those forth, then they can build upon those as well. And we can in turn learn from the discoveries that they might make. And we're not always constantly having to reinvent the wheel.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. And I'm very much in favor of that mentality overall. And also when Thorbecht uses the word Nau Taili, I believe this is a word meaning currently or current.
Yeah, it's contemporary.
Yeah.
So they had speak. So when you've been around for 50 years, you have a tribal mentality, you begin to almost develop your own tongue, your own language as it is. And Thetesmen have been greatly influenced by, he was an English priest and poet by the name, I believe his name was William Barnes, and he put forth the idea of English, that being the Nau Taili or the modern English tongue, with all the Latinisms and Normanisms removed from it. So, for example, that you'll often hear Thetesmen say strange things. So instead of community, we might say folkdom. Instead of tradition or custom, we might say thu. Instead of saying the divine presence, we might say godly therewithness. And we find that this is quite important because we're also great believers in the theory of linguistic relativity. And what that is the language that you think in, the language that you speak, the language that you think in shapes your worldview. And so it's unusual. We find it to be odd that in now tightly heathendom, so many are comfortable using Latinisms and using Greekisms and in foreign words for concepts that are inherent to us. And it also changes the way we think about things. So, for example, theidspin don't refer to prayer. We refer to bidding. So we bid the gods, right? And that's a little, it means the same thing as we pray to the gods, right? But when you say we bid to the gods, right, or we bid the gods, there is a shift. There's a shift in the way you begin to think about things. And so I do apologize to your listeners in advance if I slip into a bit of English from time to time.
No, I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful. I mean, completely separately and you know, it was beyond my knowledge that people such as yourself had this approach to heathenry using English words. And it's actually a preference that I had when writing lyrics for my musical project Walkensman. Since the first album, all lyrics have been in English.
You resurrected some wonderful, you brought back to life, I guess, to use the English instead of resurrected, some truly wonderful English words. And you have a true craft for alliteration as well, or front rhyming, as we might say.
Oh, thank you very much. Yeah, I've actually very much enjoyed it. Particularly, I mean, there's one song on the Walkensman demo called Who's Upon the Shimmering Path, which I re-recorded for the first album. And when I wrote the demo, I wasn't concerned about using English words. But when I came to do the first album and I re-recorded that song, I had to almost translate, you know, parts of the lyrics into English. And there were some particularly difficult moments, like I'd used the word sound in the original song, and sound is not a Germanic word. It's not an English word. So finding a word for sound in Old English or a word that derives from Old English is actually very difficult. I mean, in German, I believe they use the word Klang, you know, which we still use in modern English, but it wasn't fitting for that moment in the song. And I don't know if Klang has an English cognate. So I ended up saying, rather than saying hooves that sound, I think I said hooves are heard. So I changed it in that way, you know, but it was quite a challenge. And but
and that alliterates as well.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah, indeed. Yeah. And I enjoyed it very much. And I do appreciate, actually, I think this leads on well to the next talking point, really, which is the advantages of the Theidish approach. You know, you have quite a, as I've said, as you've said, you have quite a faithful, meticulous way of recreating a particular era of heathen Old England. And some people might look at that and wonder why you go to such efforts to do that, you know, why you're so strict about the language you use, the attire that you wear. And I'm conscious while I'm speaking that I'm definitely not using English words here, you know, words like attire. But if you, you know, you mentioned a moment ago the idea that the language that you speak in informs the way that you think and your worldview in general. Mm-hmm. So right there, we've got one example of the advantages of this kind of strict reconstruction that you engage in. But would you like to speak a bit more about that? Perhaps elaborate on the aspect of language and what advantages that gives you and what you believe it does to the strength of the religion. But any other advantages and strengths that you see in this approach that you have?
Well, I think I'll offer a broad comment about our approach. Theidsmen are known to be reconstructionists. And so we spend a lot of time in old documents or looking over archaeological finds or whatever it is, piecing together the rites and the traditions and the worldview of our ancestors. So one way that makes us different is because as men living in a post-Christian and a post-modern age, as theidsmen, we don't presume to know how our ancestral troth would have continued to develop had it not been interrupted by Christianity. And I think that's an assumption. A lot of people assume that they know how it would have been, that they would have been just like us, but using these words. Mm. And so we don't believe that we can rediscover the elder troth by projecting a post-Christian or a post-modern understanding religion onto the worship of our ancient heathen ancestors. I'm reminded by a quote by C.S. Lewis where he said, "A post-Christian man is not a pagan. You might as well think that a married woman recovers her virginity by divorce." Right? So I think a lot of times there's the mistake of projecting post-Christian, post-modern understandings of religion onto the past. To us, it seems wiser to then to reach back into the well of weird, to a time when our gods were last worshipped. And as statesmen, a lot of times we're accused of turning back the clock. And that's really not the case. It's picking up where we left off, right? And it's our hope that in doing so, that we'll rediscover and even regain a more authentic pre-Christian heathen worldview. And so it's a lot of work. It is. Why do we worship the gods in the old English tongue? So, of course, you know, linguistic relativity plays some role in that. But for the most part, it's because we earnestly believe in our gods. And we believe that they're worthy of such an effort on our part. And I think that a lot of now tidily heathens assume that there are things that have been lost in the old religion. There is nothing that has been lost, because this is the religion of our gods, and our gods are still alive, and they remember their troth. They remember their thu. And just as they once communicated that to shamans, to shopes, to scalds, to priests, to sacrificers, to kings and the heroes of yore, if we reach back to the point where we left off, if we show them that kind of effort and that we believe in them and that they are indeed worth that kind of effort, then they'll meet us. They'll meet us, and we will begin to receive woad and inspiration and insight and visions again. So I think that is one of the, that truly is the reason why Thadesmen do what they do. Also, one of the things that we receive from the gods that's quite important to us is something called Hadal. Hadal meaning, as in Westuhol, or Astuhadal, depending on how, what dialect one wants to use there. But Hadal meaning hail, but it means health, but it also meant omen, right? And it's generally when Thadesmen talk about luck, we go through this effort to worship the gods in their own tongue, and to gather to them in the old poetic form, because poetry is the language of mythology. It's the language of the gods, so that we might receive from them and give our best offerings to them. So we might receive their hadal, not just their health, but their omens. Thadesmen are great believers in soothsaying. We're quite a very primitive group of pagans. We're a very superstitious lot. So those would be some of the, and then it also, I think one of the other strengths that we get from this is by going native, essentially is what Thadesmen do. One of our early founders in the old Witten Thade from back in the 1970s was a woman by the name of Alfwina. And she was I believe she was an anthropology major. And so linguistic anthropology is one of the things that she introduced to Thadesmen, but just anthropology in general. And there's a concept in anthropology of going native. You know, you don the garb, you say the words. It's almost a sympathetic magic in a sense, right? You go through the motions, but you go through the motions and you mean it. Hmm. And then at some point it clicks and it becomes true.
Yeah, there's a lot there. There's a mark per year from the Norowena Society, who some of the listeners might be aware of, which is, I believe, probably best described as a publisher in America who put out some excellent books, which I've not yet read myself, but I've heard very good things about. And I did watch recently a video by Mark Perrier about strong religion, where he talks about the importance of a strict practice of the religion. And one of the things he mentioned in there is that his group are not looking to turn back the clock, or they're not looking to relive a certain time in history. They're looking to reconnect the chain that's been broken. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't say that's exactly the same approach as the Thadish belief, but there is an aspect of that you can't simply be a post-Christian worshipping the gods using certain language and be a pagan. You do need to almost try to, certainly in a ritual sense, erase the last 1,500 years, really.
So a great book that I would recommend to you and to your readers, if you haven't heard of it yet, is a book called The Germanization of Early Medieval Christianity. And it's by James C. Russell.
I've heard of it, but I've not read it yet. Yeah.
Yeah, one of the ideas that he puts forward in there is he talks a bit about conversion and conversions of a society. And so every society has something he calls BAVB. That's beliefs, attitudes, values, and behaviors. And oftentimes when you have a conversion, such as when the Germanic peoples were originally converted to Christianity, it's a superficial conversion. Mm-hmm. It's a veneer of Christianity put over top of ancient Germanic BAVB, beliefs, attitudes, values, and behaviors. And it takes centuries for those underlying beliefs, attitudes, values, and behaviors to change. And so not just we Thadesmen, but we all now tidily heathens, we have our work cut out for us, right? Because even if we weren't raised, even if we weren't reared in a Christian household, we were reared in a post-Christian household, in a postmodern age. And there is a lot of baggage there. To become a Thadesman, one has to enter a period of learnership, because to become a Thadesman is more than a matter of religious conversion. It's a process of enculturation and eventual initiation into our tribal society. It's very similar to how one converts to Judaism, because, you know, Judaism is a tribal identity. It is the belief of the tribe of Judah and so forth. And, you know, in this period of learnership, it's not just learning heathen lore, right? Or not just learning Thadish thew or Thadish custom, but it's also unlearning those Christian, post-Christian, modern and postmodern beliefs, attitudes, values, and behaviors. And that can be quite difficult. It's a process that takes anywhere from a year to three, depending upon how far away, maybe a little longer. But and for every Thadesman who does it goes through an ordeal. Right. Because there's something that you're going to have to unlearn, right, that you don't necessarily realize you're going to have to unlearn. And there's going to be something about the old religion that enrages you, right, that offends you. Ancient wisdom offends modern sensibility. And there'll be something that every individual Thadesman comes across and has to struggle with. Something about the old religion that they don't like. It just rubs them the wrong way. And, you know, you have two options there. You can excise that from the old religion and simply create your own new religion inspired upon the old religion, right? But that's not conversion. Or you can have a change of heart. You can have a change of mind, a change of worldview, right? And begin to adopt the worldview held by our ancestors. And that's quite a difficult thing to do. But it's a lot of times we look for a Thadesman to have undergone that ordeal, to have finished that ordeal, or they're recognized by the Thadis reach or their folkdom as having fully worthed themselves. So worthed themselves from the Old English werthon to become. And once a Thadesman has truly worthed themselves, it's only then that they're allowed to swear their Thadish hold oath and to become part of the Thadish, what we call a web of oaths. And those are the bonds outside of blood kinship that bind our tribal society together.
Yeah. So obviously the post-Christian era is actually better described as materialistic. I mean, most people that we know, particularly over here, I think in America, there is still a stronger Christian community, particularly in the sort of Midwest and that. But here in Britain, there are very few real pious Christians. So what we really have in the post-Christian era is materialism. And I think it's important to remember that materialism is just as at odds with heathenry as Christianity is. And where I could make a connection there and lead this conversation on is that in order to be superstitious in the way that our heathen ancestors were, you do need to outright reject materialism. You know, you just mentioned now that there needs to be an unlearning, you know, an almost kind of eureka moment that someone has before they are suitable for becoming a Thadesman. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can look to my own experiences with my meeting with Woden, which, as you mentioned earlier, was detailed in episode number 5. My meeting with Woden at Wayland Smithy in England. And the materialist mind cannot for a moment comprehend such an event. You know, that they will never accept that I had a meeting with what they would deem to be a mythological being. You know, it's to them it's not just implausible, it's outright crazy. But that type of event, that understanding, that comes from a superstitious, the understanding of someone who has that experience or who accepts that experience as a real one, comes from a superstitious place. And, you know, in the warm up for this conversation, you mentioned that those of you within Theodish belief tend to be quite superstitious. And just before I ask you for your take on that whole thing, I just wanted to mention that, just to pick up on an earlier point, when you talked about going back to or reconstructing a historical time rather than a more modern time, which enables us to be closer to the gods. You know, we've all seen films or TV shows or things like that where, you know, there's a group of kids or a group of people who are trying to, save the world by, collecting a certain amulet or a stone or something, or, you know, whatever, and taking it to a certain place. We have, I think, you know, an example I could give is the film The Fifth Element, where they I forget her name, I think it's Lilu actually, and she is the fifth element of this. And they're trying to, they go to this sacred site and they're trying to reconstruct this particular set of events, which is going to save the galaxy. And it's almost, you know, if I may kind of compare it to that in a similar way, if you want something to work, if you want something magical or metaphysical to work correctly as it should, or have some kind of power to it, then it makes sense that you would try to recreate the conditions that were there when it last worked. So if mm-hmm. we were to look to our ancestors and say, well, they understood, they knew the gods clearly because, you know, everything that they wrote from a certain time refers to their knowledge of the gods and goddesses. So clearly they knew the gods and goddesses. How did they do that? Right. Well, if we behave in a manner which is as close as possible to them, even if it's just during the rituals where we're trying to connect with the gods, then we're more likely to have that stronger connection. Yeah. What do you think about that, Thorbecht?
I mean, I think that that's spot on. So one aspect of rekindling the old belief in its fullness, which is the aim of Theedsmen, has been, and this has been a bit controversial in now tightly heathenism, particularly here in America, is the renewal of the institution of sacral kingship. So at the heart of the Theedish beliefs, tribal folkdom, at the heart of its web of oaths, is a renewed cult of kingship. And this is a concept that was put forward by a scholar by the name of William Cheney back in 1970 in his book, The Cult of Kingship in Anglo-Saxon England. It's out of print now. You can typically find a used copy, hardbound, for about $30. It's well worth it, and it's truly required reading for most Theedish Laternos to truly grasp that. Sacral kingship is the notion that the king is gold-sprung, so he's from the line of nobility, and that as a kuning from the words kun, which means kind or kin or tribe, and ing meaning belonging to or descended from. So the kuning is the one who is the representative of the tribe. And what the kuning's responsibility is to hold the luck of his richa, right? To offer bloat, that is to offer livestock on behalf of the folk of the fellowships within his richa. And the sort of priestly aspect of kingship is somewhat forgotten in Germanic understandings of kingship, especially once you have Christianity come along and modern aspects of kingship. Once Christianity came along and instead of being God-sprung kunings, you had divine right monarchy. And things of the sort. Instead of sacral kunings, you had these absolute reigns and such. But in some of the Slavic and Baltic tongues, from a proto-Slavic borrowing of the Germanic kuningage, we get in Lithuanian, in Polish, in Czech, words which are descended from kuning, all of which they use for clergy, priests. So And so that was one of the responsibilities. The king had to offer bloat to the gods on behalf of his tribe. If he failed to offer bloat, and this is not just particular to continental tribes. It's not just particular to the Anglo-Saxons either. Any heathen who's read the Ynglinga saga in the Heimskringla will be aware of the notion of sacral kingship as well, or can easily find it throughout the Heimskringla. The king had to offer bloat on behalf of his folk, and in doing so, he ensured bountiful harvests. He gained the gods half their luck for victory in war. And if the king failed to make bloat, or if he did not make lucky bloat over time, his witten ymote could have been called, and certainly he could have been removed, maybe even offered as a bloat himself. But so that is very much so tied up to our very primitive understanding of paganism, of heathenry. The kunin must also oversee that all Thu native traditions are upheld, and so he might preside over moot, folkymult, or witnymult, or thing, right? So court proceedings and such. Theidsmen, and it's important here that the Theidish kuning is quite different from the medieval king. The Theidish kuning doesn't dictate law; he follows Thu, and Thu custom is essentially common law. It's based upon the custom of the people. You know, what did our ancestors do? And what have we done? What has been our tradition as well? It's also based upon past deemings. So when matters were brought, you know, forward to the Witten ymote, to the folk ymote or such, and judgments were made. And so we tend to build upon that. It's also based upon ideas of inheritance that run throughout Theidish Thu and the belief as well. So, you know, the king really is responsible that the sacral kuning, which Garmin Lord was our Arist kuning, he was our first kuning, is really responsible for maintaining the luck of not the individual Theidsman, not necessarily even the individual Theid, but the Theidus region as a whole. So, and, you know, I mentioned Hadal before, the idea of luck, which can mean health and it can mean omen. And our belief in Hadal, our belief in warding the luck of the tribe, is something that drives so much of what we Theidsmen do and how we think about things. And because of this, this is what really marks us as being superstitious or primitive. But I mentioned before that we're great believers in soothsaying and in signs. Theidsmen will never engage upon any great undertaking without reading the runes, right? And they will also, especially here in the Eldritcha Theid, there's a great tradition of fugurquata, or divination by the songs and flight patterns of birds. But Theidsmen are always paying attention to some sort of sign, a change in the wind, a drop in temperature, the crackling of the fire, billowing of smoke, you know, when offerings have been placed into the fire, even the creaking of trees. And our belief in this is so great that when the COVID panic happened, or the COVID pandemic happened, and there was a lot of panic about the COVID pandemic, what you saw throughout Nautile heathenry, at least I saw on social media, was a great many fellowships saying that they were going to stop holding gatherings. And for Theidsmen, this was absolutely unthinkable. Why would we cut ourselves off from the gods and the hara, the luck, the health that we receive from them? And so we held every single holy tide during the pandemic. For the first couple, we took some additional precautions because we didn't know what this thing was at the time. It was all the stories being told about it were quite scary. And, you know, maybe it was in those early days. And so we took some sensible precautions, a little bit of distancing, not drinking after one another with the horn. But, of course, as the lockdowns went on and it became obvious that I guess the time of crisis had truly passed, and this was now about something else. All that kind of went to the wayside for us.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear about your superstitious aspects to me, because I think one of my mistaken beliefs about Theidish belief has been that you are perhaps, you know, dare I say it, too academic. That's certainly been my impression from the, you know, the limited amount that I've known about what you do over the years. And I'm someone who is quite in favor of what people call UPG, unverified personal gnosis, but it has to be balanced with a knowledge of the tradition or the Thu.
Indeed.
It's finding that perfect balance to me, because I do believe that there are some groups out there and some well-known pagan, you know, historians or content creators and things, which I would say are perhaps a little bit too academic for my preferences. But there are some who are not who rely too much on instinct and just kind of going with the flow and not paying enough attention to tradition and things like that. So it sounds to me like you strike a very healthy balance there between knowing the tradition, knowing the lore, as well as one possibly can do, or it, certainly endeavoring to know it as well as one can do, but also being very superstitious, as you say, paying attention to the flight patterns of birds and the runes and things like that. Things which are, well, I mean, you know, in you know, superstitious, you know, that's, I think that's the best term for it. So yeah, it's, I think it's important, but with regards to kingship, can I just ask what your opinion is of what we have now in England, King Charles? You know, what would the Theodish view of King Charles be?
My goodness. Well, so, you know, we have theidsmen in Commonwealth countries, such as Canada and Australia. And, you know, there has been some interesting discussion as to what the British monarchy means to a theidsman. And mm-hmm. I think that we have a great deal of respect for the institution of the monarchy. But this is a Christian monarchy. It's not a heathen sacral kingship. It's a very different sort of thing. And mm-hmm. you know, Charles, of course, I guess, is the governor or the head of the English church. I believe he's going to maybe be dubbed defender of the faiths as opposed to the faith. But, you know, I think that it's, I think our opinion of it is a lot like our opinion of the Catholic Church, right? So, theidsmen tend to think favorably of it because it preserves a great number of traditions, and it's a starting point back into the past. You know, in the Catholic Church and in the Anglican Church, which I have a bit more of a background in, there are a number of heathen folk customs and traditions and even holidays that were sort of carried over. And then they were Christianized, but if you de-Christianize them, it kind of gives you a path back to the past, back to the belief of our forelders, which we find is not dead after all, but a living tradition. Mm. And so I think that our view of the British monarchy would be the same way. We have a bit of respect for it. We also realize that it potentially could be hostile towards us, the same way Catholics could potentially be hostile towards us. But we have an appreciation for, I guess, the cultural artifacts preserved in that institution.
Mm. Yeah, it's somewhat similar to my view on it. I am pro-monarchy, you know, theoretically, but I'm not in favor of the current monarchy, and not just because they are a Christian of the Christian persuasion. But anyway, I didn't want to go too deeply into that. I was just curious because, you know, you do have this strong adherence to tradition. And obviously, kingship is a very important aspect of Theodish belief. So, yeah, it's interesting to hear. But, you know, I guess as heathens, it's difficult for us to look to the current British monarchy and see how that in any way embodies our notions of sacral kingship. So we can appreciate aspects of it. We can appreciate it for being some form of monarchy, but perhaps the, you know, digging any deeper than that, it doesn't really have much to offer us.
No, I wrote a paper. I have a master's in English religious history, and I wrote a paper called From Woden to the Virgin Queen. And I talked about, you know, of course, Henry VIII in his unhappy, you know, marriage bed and the reasons for breaking with the Roman Church. But I also talked about that sort of being a reasserting of, in a sense, a memory of sacral kingship. Not that he was really an atavism of sacral kingship, sort of because it's not really, I'm sure he didn't know what it was. He was identifying as a Celt, but which they had their own sacral kingship. But the I think that in that I underscored and probably gave as much of a heathen sort of overview of how we might look at, you know, Christian kingship as it succeeded us, as that being really steps away from sacral kingship incrementally. You see it with Offa and a number of other kings. There's various steps away from that. But then there's atavisms. There are times where the old spirit sort of reasserts itself. And you really have this wonderful drama throughout the Middle Ages between English kings and Germanic kings in general and the Roman pontiff, and this sort of back and forth over who has the authority. Because, you know, if the Cunin was the head of the Cun, the head of the Thaid, the head of the tribe, right, then it was the king's belief that was the tribe's belief, right? Mm-hmm. It was the Thaidan's belief that was the Thaidish belief, right, or the Thaid's belief. And which is why, of course, you know, you don't have true conversion of the Germanic countries until you're able to convert the kings, right? You have to. That's why, you know, Augustine's mission to Kent and so forth was intended towards converting the king, because once you converted the king, the folks still may hold on to their customs for quite some time, and they did even for centuries, you could begin that official point of conversion.
Yeah, officially it is a Christian nation once the king is Christian.
Yes.
Yeah.
And right. It changes the law as well. Mm. So this is one thing that's fascinating. If you look at the Icelanders, when they held their thing in the year 1000, and it was, you had the Christian camp and the heathen camp, right? And they were at odds, and they were almost, you know, drawing arms upon one another there. Each declared that the other was out of law, right? That they did not share the same law with one another. And what you'll find is an ancient Germanic religion, that the concept of law, not as legislation, right, but law as in tradition and so forth, is very much so tied up into the notion of religion and the cult of the gods as well.
Yeah, indeed. And whereas, you know, and just going back a little bit to what you said earlier, common law is derived from pre-Christian England. You know, we can see the traces of Anglo-Saxon pagan worldview in common law, as you said, in the idea of precedence being set and it being based on natural law and this kind of unwritten law, essentially. So, but whereas when we were Christianized, I say when, you know, our nations at large were Christianized, the Bible came to take a very prominent role in what law was, and obviously people swear on the Bible and things like that. And, you know, to this day, you know, because I do have quite a strong interest in common law and understanding the true nature of law in common law countries, and you do find that most of the folk who are into that stuff tend to be Christian, or at the very least they do look to the Christian religion as the kind of safeguard of common law. I've been at kind of great pains to try and inform people that actually Christianity is not a prerequisite for living in a common law society.
No, indeed. We have a saying in the Thetis Reacher that that it's a lawless society. And it's not a lawless society in the sense that there's no law. You know, we have the law, but there's no legislation, right? Law is not legislated. The Thetis Kunin, the Thetis Reacher, the Winland Reacher, doesn't create law. The Witten Yemot doesn't get together and legislate law, right? Rather, we uphold it by upholding traditions, by upholding precedent, and by making demons, judgments based upon those traditions and those precedents.
Yeah, as heathens, our belief is that the law has always been there. It's been there since the dawn of man, and it doesn't need creating any further. That we don't need new legislations written. It's already there. It's just a case of uncovering it or paying heed to it.
Indeed.
Yeah. So your background is, you know, and I did originally mean to get to this a bit earlier in the conversation, but I'd really like to hear more about your background as an Anglican. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong here, but you were some kind of minister within the Anglican Church?
Well, I was a candidate for holy orders.
Right.
Or okay. Postulant. So as a young man, I was a member of a high church Anglo-Catholic offshoot of the American Episcopal Church. So the Episcopal Church in America is the American branch of the Anglican Communion. Right. So, and high church Episcopalians or those conservative and traditionalist ones who have broken from the Episcopal Church over years, a lot of times will refer to themselves as Anglicans or Anglo-Catholics. I belonged to a small local parish where I served as an acolyte and then later as a lay reader. And this was in my 20s that I was most active, especially as a lay reader. The priest of our parish, he was an elderly fellow. He was in his 80s and he was in poor health. And because of this and because of a shortage of clergy in our province, I was called upon by the church members and also the bishop to assist the priest with the mass and with other services. Now, of course, I couldn't perform the blessing or consecrate the host. I didn't have apostolic authority, but I would certainly step in and do my best, do all the things that a layman could do, including giving the homily. I was licensed to write my own homilies. And I even briefly enrolled in seminary. It didn't last, and it didn't last because I discovered theistic belief, but to circle back to Anglicanism, I was enthralled by the magical nature of the Mass, by the blessing of the fields on Rogation days. Although we don't have them here in America, I was fascinated by the English tradition of the veneration of holy wells, well dressings, and so forth. I understood that the cult of the saints was essentially a many-godded cult. I understood that that our veneration of the Virgin Mary was the worship of a mother goddess. I understood that the revering of saintly relics was essentially an ancestral cult, right? The worship of ancestors. And I was also aware of the many other heathen customs that had been absorbed by the Anglo-Saxon church. I mean, I'd read Bede's Ecclesiastical History. I understood that it was the church's mission to incorporate as much of the heathen custom as they could to ease conversion, and that so much of that had been carried over. And in my heart, I yearned for Woden's religion, right? I truly wanted to be a heathen. But, you know, this is in 98, 99. You know, Woden's dead, right? And his religion's forgotten. It's hopelessly lost. And then I happened to stumble upon online, and the internet was still fairly new in our homes at the time, an article by Garmin Lord called The Mystery of Heathen Sacrifice. And that's when I first learned about Thetish belief. And I was blown away because they had spent, first of all, they'd been around since 1976, the entirety of my life. And they weren't just renewing the worship of the old gods. I mean, I was aware of, I knew Wiccans and the people of the sword who were neo-pagans who were worshiping the old gods, but they were so earnest about it. They were feigning the gods. They were writing gelders in old English, the Anglo-Saxon tongue. They were offering bloat. I was very impressed by the fact they offered bloat, livestock to the gods. I mean, wow, what a break with, whereas in the Mass we have sort of like a bloodless bloat, right? A bloodless offering. Here they were at times, because many Theatesmen, you'll find about half of Theatish fellowships will at least have someone there who is a farmer or raises some sort of livestock or something. To go that deep into it, it unsettled me. And I have to say, I've told Garmin himself this, the night I came upon The Mystery of Heathen Sacrifice was both the greatest and worst night of my life. And I say it was the worst night because it was the greatest night because I realized that Woden's religion, Woden was not dead. He was alive. And his religion had been remembered and renewed and rekindled. But here I was, a seminarian. And, you know, the trajectory of my life for several years had been to become an Anglican priest, and there were a lot of family expectations behind that. There were friend circles. I had social obligations, and I knew that I was going to have to hurt some people. And I knew that to be true, because I knew that I couldn't continue to, on the course that I was on, I couldn't continue to become an Anglican priest. And I certainly couldn't become an Anglican priest and then worship Woden in private. That wasn't going to happen. I had to be true to our gods. And so that was, it was, like I said, it was the, it was a tremendous night. It was gut wrenching. But pretty much by the time I was done with the article, maybe an hour afterwards, I knew that I had no real choice. I had to begin my journey towards becoming a Theatesman. I had to start worthing myself and reaching out to Theatesmen, finding out how to become part of the Wineland Reacher.
Oh, what a wonderful story. You know, I do often wonder, you know, that in kind of broader sort of dissident circles, people who are a bit outside of kind of the mainstream worldview, there does tend to be a bit of, you know, tussle between Christians and pagans. And I do often think that many of the Christians who are quite, you know, vociferously opposed to paganism and doubtful that it can ever really work as any kind of wider folk religion beyond a few fringe groups, I think that they tend to fear what it means to put yourself out there as a pagan. You know, for example, you know, I live in a rural area, the kind of place where you don't have many neighbours very nearby, but you do know all of the neighbours who are within a kilometre or two of you, or a mile or two of you, you know. And, you know, I do often wonder what they make of seeing the hammer around my neck, you know, because in mm-hmm. areas like this, if there are Christians remaining, they are in rural areas of Wales and England and Scotland, rather than the more urban areas. So, you know, and when you live in a rural area, you want to be on good terms with your neighbours. You know, it's just human nature to want to be on good terms with your neighbours. And I think some people do tend to worry that by showing themselves as a pagan or a heathen, they are perhaps immediately, automatically putting themselves at odds with potential allies, you know, their community. And I think you experienced that at quite a concentrated level with the expectations that had been placed upon you to continue with Anglicanism, and the disappointment that must have occurred when you actually turned around and said, "Well, actually, no, my heart is with heathen tradition and with heathenry and with the gods."
Yeah, one thing that I would say, you know, there has been. I'm familiar with what you're talking about, especially, you know, we get a lot of nasty comments on some of our social media posts, our YouTube, by some of these sort of traditionalist Catholic types or mm-hmm. things of the sort, who I think that they're offended that we're not on board with what they're on board with. And, you know, here in America, we typically saw that sort of mentality amongst the evangelicals, especially during the satanic panic of the throughout the 80s and into the early 90s, which you know, Theatesmen found themselves, as many also truer did at the time, targets of that sort of moral panic, just as sometimes we find ourselves targets of, I guess, the woke moral panic that's been going on for about the past 10 years or so. The one thing that I have found, an approach that we have taken in the Old Reach of Theat in particular, as we've endeared ourselves to a great many of our Christian neighbors. Matter of fact, we have both an Episcopalian, a gentleman who's an Episcopalian, and another elderly gentleman who is an Anglican from England, so he's from the Church of England, who attend most of our feignings. And the reason they do that is we incorporate so many folk customs and traditions that both of these men are, you know, older, they remember from their youth. So we invite them when we set up the maypole, right, in the month of Thrymirka, to dance the maypole. They themselves, with their knees, don't necessarily jump over the fire at midsummer, but they certainly enjoy seeing us do it. And we try to, you know, when we go to charm the plow, or we go to, you know, bless the fields at Soldermanna for the Akrabolt. Of course, we invite them to that. It happens quite early in the morning, though. But or dawn Aestra services, when we greet Aestra, the goddess of the beginning of summer and dawn. We invite them to that. Just so many of these traditions, the Harvest Queen, when we crowned the Harvest Queen, they remember these things from their youth. And because of that sort of commonality, it's endeared us to them. And we may be an oddity in Altaïli heathendom, but some of our greatest defenders, especially here locally in the neighborhood and in the surrounding community, have been our Christian good folk.
That's fascinating. That's really interesting. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned earlier well dressing, and I went to a well dressing last year. And
did you?
Obviously, it was held by a church. Yeah, yeah. And I just, you know, it was a lovely little church. You know, I do quite enjoy the atmosphere that can be present in these old English churches and things. But I could not for the life of me understand why. Nobody seems to be able to see, none of these Christians who attend these events seem to be able to see how pagan that mm-hmm. ritual is, the well dressing. I mean, it's undeniably pagan, and yet they embrace it wholeheartedly, you know. And I think, you know, what you just mentioned there about many of these local Christians enjoying these festivities from their youth, the maypole dance and things like that, I think that in most cases, those are the aspects of Christianity that most Christians truly enjoyed. You know, I think if they were to be truly honest with themselves and say, you know, is it being sat on the pews, you know, listening to sermons? Is it even the hymns, or is it the festivities, the high holy tides, as you would call them, that you really truly enjoyed? And I think if they were really honest with themselves, they would say it's those festivals.
And that's what I loved about the Anglican Church myself. The other thing that we weave in, we do a lot of Morris dancing, and we do mummers plays. And those are always, you know, some deep mysteries that can be conveyed, especially in the mummers plays. But they're done with such mirth and merriment, right? That it offers sort of it's a way to touch other people, to connect with them in a way that's not very threatening. But when you look at the mummer's play, for example, just your traditional mummer's play, if you have your hero who fights a villain, perhaps a dragon, and he's slain, and then the hero is resurrected, right? When you find this in the Volsunga saga, you know, where you have the uncle and nephew, the names are escaping me right now, I do apologize, and the young lad, he is slain by his uncle, right? And then he is... the raven comes down with a magical herb and such, and the young lad is renewed and restored to life. You find several instances in the dramatic lore, and I think it's like a Manarbund initiation rite, where a young man has to slay a mock monster. So Thjalfi slain Mistkalf, Thunar's Thane, Thjalfi slays Mistkalf, while Thunar fights Hrungnir, I think is another example where you sort of find that. And so it kind of gives you a way of, you know, in this very mirthful, sort of playful way. And, you know, one of the ancient Germanic words for sacrifice, lock, also means play, right? So it's a sort of sport or the sort of play that you can engage in. And I think that it's a great way to begin introducing people to deeper mysteries.
Yes, and those who follow Eldrice Riche on Instagram and things like that, you can see video footage and photos of Thorbecht's group performing many of these rites, even, you know, the mumming plays and maypole dancing and things like that. So they do, you know, they provably do uphold these traditions themselves. And I would say they're the group that does that to the fullest extent that I know of. You know, most heathen groups tend to gather to perform bloat or cymbal, you know, several times a year. But in terms of recreating the full breadth or reliving the full breadth of these old traditions, these old English traditions, the Thaedish belief tends to do that more so than any other.
Yeah, we truly enjoy sharing those on Instagram. Not really on Facebook quite as much. I think we have a page there. Pretty much just to announce when magazine issues or booklets or other publications come out. But Instagram is such a great platform. Well, caveat, it's owned by Metaverse, but it's we enjoy being able to share images. And we've received a lot of comments from people over the years that these things have inspired them And they have then taken up some of these practices and renewed some of these things as well. And that's really wonderful to see. I mean, we all benefit by having the reawakening spread farther and to go deeper.
One of the things I love about third-ish belief is actually how formal you tend to be. And this is something that I'm only coming to realize in more recent times myself in my own heathen practice, is how informal and incorrectly informal I'd been for many years. You know, not, you know, things like performing ablutions before meeting and performing bloat, you know, simply washing, dressing well before the gods, before the folk and things like that. And, you know, I'd say a few years ago, I'd be perhaps a little bit perplexed to see Thorbecht and others, you know, dressed to the nines, you know, dressed in this very formal garb and performing rites in a very formal manner. And to be honest, even in the organization of this podcast, Thorbecht has been quite formal, more so than many of my guests have been. You know, we had a preliminary chat off the record, and, you know, we set dates and everything quite far in advance. And I actually really appreciate that formality, to be quite honest with you. And I think it's actually very befitting of heathen faith, more so than most heathens acknowledge. So it's something that I'm trying to emphasize more in my own practice, is being stricter with myself, being on time, presenting myself in a certain way. And, you know, as we discussed earlier, even speaking in a certain way is very important. And, you know, when you really think about it, you know, why wouldn't you? When you're placing yourself before the gods and trying to create as close a connection with them as possible, why would you not present yourself in such a way, in such a as though you'd made an effort, you know, to do things at a certain specific time, holding your rites on the correct dates, you know, without deviating, without being casual about it, you know. The least that our gods and ancestors and the whites of the land around us deserve is to be treated in such a manner. So, yeah, that is, I have to say, that is something that I very much appreciate about what you do, Thorbecht. And you can see that in all of the rites that you perform, the ceremonies, the mumming plays, the Morris dancing, the maypole and everything that you do. You do take this stuff very seriously, and you don't tend to skip any of it, right?
No, we're very thorough. And, you know, as far as being formal goes, I'm reminded of a passage from Tacitus's Germania, where he says in Germania, that good manners prevail more there than good laws do elsewhere.
Mm.
And so for us, there's a great deal of respect that thetadesmen show one another. Of course, we show the gods. And then, of course, even in my initial correspondences with you, because I'm thinking as the head of a tribal folkdom, you introduced me as an ambassador, but I'm thinking of you as an ambassador, as representing your audience and a group of people. And so there is a great deal of formality that goes to it. It's not stiff formality. It's a friendly formality, but but there is a thoroughness in the way we go about things. Yes.
Yeah, absolutely. So it's a warm formality rather than a cold formality, I think might be a good way of putting it.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, to move on. So I wanted to ask you about, you know, I mentioned it briefly earlier, but this whole Norse heathen revivalism, you know, the popularity of Vikings, you know, this has been something. I mean, I remember when hearing rumors about a TV show that was being made called Vikings on the History Channel. I remember hearing about that. And to be quite honest with you, my heart sank a little because I knew I knew what would unfold from that. And by that point in time, I'd already been, frankly, a little bit concerned by the fact that so many English and English, ancestrally English people, by the fact that they had already veered towards this more Norse paganism, this Norse heathenism, rather than something more close to their own ancestral tradition. And I knew that when the Vikings TV show came out, that it was only going to exacerbate that what I wouldn't call it a problem, but that trend. And what you do with third-ish belief is obviously quite at odds with that. So how do you feel you know, are you happy with the kind of the way that Anglo-Saxon tradition is, you know, its place in the world? Are you happy that it gets enough acknowledgement in comparison to the more Norse tradition, or do you still think there's a huge imbalance there?
Well, I'm not particularly concerned about the imbalance. I look at this as a process of remembrance. So there in England, under the Tudors, the English began to reject their Anglo-Saxon identity in favor of a Celtic one, partly because the Tudors were Welsh, but partly because the Roman Church, the Anglo-Saxon missions, had brought over the Roman Church, whereas the Celtic inhabitants of the Isles who adopted Christianity had a different branch of Christianity. And so one of the things Henry VIII really needed to put forward was that Christianity in England wasn't beholden to the Pope. A great book that I would recommend on this topic is Literature, Nationalism, and Memory in Early Modern England and Wales by a chap by the name of Philip Schweitzer. Tremendous insights into how the English began to forget their Englishness or their Anglo-Saxon identity. Now, here in America, at least, we had a great divorce from Britain. You know, we had the American Revolution. And in breaking with Britain, we largely rejected our Anglo-Saxon identity. And over a number of generations, families forgot their English origins. It's very common. You know, they say that that in America, I guess the English, were, at least for the longest time, were the largest ethnic group, especially here on the East Coast. But what you'll find is that people with English surnames will often still identify as something other than English. If there's a little bit of German in their ancestry, that's what they'll identify with. Yeah. So there's this kind of great forgetting that's gone on there. Now, during the 1960s and 1970s, you saw a pagan reawakening, and you also saw these folk music revivals. And it was at this time that here in America, at least, we began to notice more and more Americans embracing a Celtic identity, or even Celtic expressions of heathenry and paganry, we Anglo-Saxon theatesmen being an oddity there during that period of time. Then in the 1980s, we began to observe that it's also true began to kind of gain a larger following in the 80s and 90s. We saw the very same phenomenon, but with a Nordic identity. So those who were of English ancestry or British ancestry or such, identifying as Vikings, Northmen, and maybe following even not even just a broadly Norse religion, but an Icelandic specific interpretation of it, and that began to broaden over time. It really wasn't until the aughts and the 2010s that we say it's been noticed that other American heathens were beginning to embrace their Anglo-Saxon heritage, and it's really it was by the end of the 2010s that we, through social media and such, began to notice that Anglo-Saxon heathendom was finally beginning to flourish in England as well. Now, you mentioned heathenry had been around in England through the Odinic Rite and such groups since the 70s. And I'm sure that there had been other groups who had called Othin, Woden, and so forth, Thor, Thunar. But it seems like something changed there. It really began to take hold. We're seeing a great number of fellowships. I can't quite keep up with them all now. They're sprouting up. And that's so encouraging. So rather than being discouraged because of the Norse slant that things have been given, I see this as simply a process. This is Englishmen remembering who they are. And it's been a process. We've had to go from completely forgetting who we are to the sort of Celtic identity to a Nordic identity to finally coming home.
And I would actually credit, of all places, heavy metal for some of this as well, because you know, some of the listeners might know I used to play in a black metal band called Winterfilleth, which of course is named after the old English word for the October full moon. And Winterfilleth is a band that formed I think it was 2007, I think Winterfilleth formed, and from the very off, it was a celebration of Anglo-Saxon heritage. And, you know, even though none of the members of the band at that time, before I was in them, were themselves heathen, there was a focus on the heathen aspects of Anglo-Saxon England. And I remember when Winterfellowth, because they became quite popular within the extreme metal scene quite quickly. And I remember, because I was friends with the guys, you know, from the beginning, and I remember there being this sudden upsurge in people taking pride in their Anglo-Saxon heritage, and, you know, specifically their heathen Anglo-Saxon heritage. And you had other bands. There was a band called Woden's Throne at the same time. Then a few years later, you had bands like Ildra, who sings in Old English, actually. And, you know, even long before Winterfellowth, you had the band Forefather, who always called themselves English Heathen Metal, I think was the label that they used. And they're one of my favourite bands, actually, Forefather. And they always, you know, they wrote certain songs that had Old English lyrics. They always spoke about the traditions of Heathen England and things. So I think, actually, most of the people I know who really, really embraced their Anglo-Saxon heritage are actually heavy metal fans who kind of discovered it through that. And I would credit it largely for my own rediscovery of my heritage as well. So,
well done for your part in that.
Yeah. Oh, thank you. Yeah.
And you've done us all a great service there.
Well, yeah. And it's something I tried to continue with Walkinsman as well. And I have had a number of people send me emails saying, you know, I was a Walkinsman fan. And because of Walkinsman, I came to understand my Anglo-Saxon heritage, which I wasn't really aware of or didn't pay any attention to before. And then they've gone on to, you know, really study the history of Old England and of the Anglo-Saxon heathen faith. And I've even had people say, I didn't realize that there was an English paganism, you know?
Right.
And yeah, so it's that. And also I would say the books of Brian Bates as well, which, you know, I recommend quite regularly on the Fergan, but his books, you know, he had The Way of Weird. The Way of Weird, yeah, and The Real Middle Earth, which is the first one I read by him, which I think was a rebranding of a book, what was it called? Maybe called The Web of Weird or something, I can't remember, but it was, he rebranded it in the wake of the Lord of the Rings films, because there was this, you know, an upsurge of popularity, of interest in Tolkien's works. So he kind of rode on the back of that, and yeah, understandably so. And it's a good kind of overview of the superstitions, really, the superstitions and traditions of Anglo-Saxon England. So those, coupled with the heavy metal scene, and of course with Theodish belief, which, as Thorbecht has mentioned, has been going since the 70s, I think have created an environment where, once again, people are taking pride in their Anglo-Saxon heritage. Yet still, despite that, because of the Vikings TV show and because of Wardruna and all of the kind of copycat bands who have tried to sound like Wardruna since, there does tend to be, particularly among people who are newer to heathenry, they do gravitate towards the Norse side of things. And perhaps, you know, eventually they might have that realization that, hey, actually I'm English, I'm not Norwegian, or I'm not Icelandic, and it's perhaps more befitting for me to call him by the name Woden or Thunor rather than Odin or Thor. But perhaps even those who were heathen prior to that, maybe even members of the Odinic Rite and things like that, maybe this popularity of Norse Viking heathenry caused them to reassess what their real position was. Because, you know, there is this aspect of human nature where we do like to think that we were there before others, you know, that we have been, you know, waving a flag longer than others have. So maybe it may have been a way for people to, you know, turning to their Anglo-Saxon identity may have been a way for certain heathens to say, well, actually, I was here before the Vikings TV show. So if that happened, you know, then I welcome it. But I don't have any great problem with it. I do think it's a shame that there are no overt expressions of Anglo-Saxon culture in the form of kind of festivals and things, you know, we have in England, you know, but ultimately, it's all I look at it as a veneer, and it's maybe a misguided veneer or a distorted lens, perhaps we could say. But at least those people are looking towards the past, and they're coming closer to what their ancestry would expect of them.
I absolutely agree. I would say that the fact that they're not they're Viking festivals, but they're not Anglo-Saxon festivals, or there's not as many Hollywood shows made about Anglo-Saxons may be a blessing. it may be a blessing to us, because we're less likely to be misrepresented. Now, I will say, you mentioned music, and of course, you know, the role that Winterfootith and Wilkinsman have played in that. I would suggest to your listeners, if they're looking for something a bit different, something that's going to sound the way close to how historical music would have sounded, like a shope playing in the hall upon a harp or a harp or a lyre, right? I recommend Datesmen have been big pioneers of shope craft and harp sway. And they're Alfric Clavert, he's the Clavert of Frabenshire Thayet in British Columbia, has since the mid-90s been producing a number of different albums primarily in the Old English tongue. And some of them are historical gouters like Cabman's Laeth, but a great many of them are gouders and baits that either he or Garman Clawford or other Thayetsmen have written. And it's definitely, he has many of the same criticisms that you do of, not where Wardroon is a bad band per se, but whereas this contemporary heathens have really latched on just to this, and you have all these copycat bands, and there are other authentic expressions of heathen music and heathen storytelling in the neo-folk genre, such as Wilkinsman, in the metal genre, but also in that sort of reconstructionist, getting back to shopcraft, to the skaldic arts and so forth.
Yeah, absolutely. I second that recommendation highly. Alfric Avery is his full name, but he goes by the name Alfric for this the purpose of this project. And yeah, his album Mimir's Mead is wonderful. It's that is to me one of the most authentic sounding collections of heathen music that, well, certainly that I own. And although I'm not quite as familiar with the follow up album, which I believe is called Watling Street, is it?
So do you have that? If not, I'll send it to you.
I don't yet have it, right. I must admit, and it's something that I've been meaning to, because I've played Mimir's Mead to death, and I did platform it on the podcast episode which I did on pagan music. I did feature one of his songs in that and spoke a little bit about it there. So yeah, absolutely couldn't recommend that highly enough. I mean, he the lyrics for the songs on that album are varyingly between, what are they, like old Gothic, old Saxon. I think there may be a song or two in Old English, I'm not sure, but he does kind of he does make use of various old Germanic languages, and there is an immense, I don't know, it does something to the soul when you listen to it. You really feel the ancient nature of the music and of the tradition when you listen to that. So yeah, I highly
recommend Harp Runes from the All Fathers Hall. That's it's either entirely in Old English or maybe a little bit of Old Frisian. Also, Songs of the Elder Trow, but Watling Street. And I've been following Alfric's music since before I was at the Edsman. And I can tell you that Watling Street is, in my opinion, his greatest work yet. And right. I'm a tremendous fan of Songs of the Elder Trow and Harp Runes from the Old Father's Harp. But it's Watling Street is something that I listen to weekly. So
wonderful. Yeah, well, I look forward to delving into that.
Now, I did want to touch a little bit on Norse versus Anglo-Saxon heathenry, if you don't mind.
Please, yeah.
The historical differences between Norse and Anglo-Saxon heathenry, I believe, have too much has been made of those of late, right? Particularly by some Anglo-Saxon reconstructionists. It doesn't matter what any sort of postmodern historical deconstructionist academic might say. The god Woden and the god Oath are not indeed the same god.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Truly, I think the biggest difference between the gods are more or less the same. There could be some regional deities, or particularly goddesses, that might be a bit different from one to the other. But not only the gods the same, most of their customs, bloat is the same. Sumbul is largely the same, was largely the same. The biggest difference, I think one that confuses people the most, is in their calendars and when they kept their holy tides.
Yes.
So in, Bade in his Reckoning of Time says, kind of offers one chapter, just one chapter talks about the Anglo-Saxon calendar, the heathen calendar that, Bade's important witness because he lived while, Anglo-Saxon heathenry was still alive when he was a young boy. So it was still something that was known. It was still something that was remembered. So his notes on the old heathen calendar are quite important. But we know that the Norse had their own calendar, and it was slightly different. Both of these calendars were originally measured by the moon. So you would have the mona, the new mona begin the new monath, new month. And a lot of times your holy tides would be held on the full moon of that month. And they both tucked solstices into account, right? One of the areas where they were greatly different is in how they calculated leap years. Because when you have lunar months, the lunar year is shorter than the solar year. The Anglo-Saxons would add a third month of summer every so often. It's about seven times every 19 years. 19 years being a Metonic cycle, when the lunar year and the solar year sort of line back up again and reset. The Norse were a little different. I think every few years they would add 7 to 11 days, or essentially a week, in there to keep theirs going. And so the months don't always line up the same. The months didn't have the same names. They don't line up the same. But also it's important to remember that between Scandinavia and Germania, there are different climates and there are geographical differences. And because of that, the Norse, according to the Norse Reckoning of Things, they tend to hold their holy tides or some of their year tidely thews, their seasonal customs, right? Anywhere from a month to 2 months after the Anglo-Saxons do. So, for example, the Anglo-Saxons, Bade says that they held their great Yule festival, Moldernicht, on the winter solstice, right? But if you look at the Heimskringla, Dittmar Hersberg, some other sources, what we find is that the Norse held their great Hocknacht or their Slaughter Night or their Yuletide festival, we believe, on the full moon after the new moon following the solstice, right? So that's going to be a few weeks to a month or more away from the solstice and away from the Anglo-Saxons held theirs. But we also find this not just with Yule, right? So we find, for example, we Thadesmen believe that the Akrabolt, the field remedy, was performed during the month of Sormonath, because certain way Bade described that the sun cakes being offered lines up with the sort of flat cakes being put into the first furrow in the Akrabolt. So we have this field remedy that's probably done around February. Now, you can plow the earth in February in England. Matter of fact, you have in January, you have the full plow, right? You have a number of plow Monday and so forth, right? So you have that tradition around January, February, or what we would have in our month of Sormonath. There's evidence amongst a very similar practice of digging a hole and offering cakes down into it survived amongst the Norse at least until the 1700s. And I truly have to thank Alfred Clobbered for finding this. This was done in April, in mid-April. And it makes sense because you can't perform the Akrabolt in February in Scandinavia. So, getting back to Alfred Clobbered and Ravenshire Thede in British Columbia, I mean, he's about 6 hours north of Vancouver. He's way out there. I think he might be closer to the North Pole than he is to my own Thede. And you can't perform the Akrabolt in February. The ground is frozen. It's covered in snow. So it makes sense. So he follows more of a Norse thew in that. Also, another great example, and one that's going to be more familiar to your listeners, is the summer pole. So in England, when did we dance the summer pole? On the beginning of May, roughly Þrymidalka, according to the old Anglo-Saxon calendar. In Sweden, they danced the pole at the midsummer solstice.
Yeah.
Right? So a couple months later. So you find this throughout the year. The Norse calendar and the Anglo-Saxon calendar, a great many of the holy tides, especially in the beginning part of the year, You'll find that they hold some of the same celebrations or observe some of the same yeartidy customs, but they do it about a month to 2 months apart. I think there's been a great confusion in contemporary heathenry because for many years, North heathens followed an Anglo-Saxon reckoning of time, and they've kind of recently in the past decade discovered the Norse had their own calendar. And now they've sort of begun to, the pendulum swung so far in that direction that they're now proclaiming things like Bade was wrong, and the Anglo-Saxon heathens didn't have their own calendar. And so we should all be celebrating Yule in January when the Norse did. But not if you're an Anglo-Saxon heathen, you shouldn't.
No, I'm very, very grateful to you for bringing this up, because this is a question which I very much wanted to ask but didn't actually make a note of in the show notes for this episode, because there was quite a bit of discussion around Yule on Telegram, which is the only real kind of social platform that I use, and it's the main platform really of the Fergan as well. And there was quite a bit of discussion about when Yule actually was. And I, you know, reference your book to Hold the Holy Tides, and I agree with your conclusions in that about when Yule is. But you had a lot, I can't possibly count the number of people who were wishing me happy Yule on like the 9th of January. And not
which
to say
fine if they're following a Norse too.
Exactly, yeah, absolutely.
Right.
I'm certainly not saying that they're wrong. But I think that what you have just outlined there explains this perfectly. And there's actually quite a bit of synchronicity here, because I just attended a bloke yesterday, actually. And the theme of the bloke was very much one of light. There was a lot of discussion of the importance of light. And it occurred to me that in, say, for example, Scandinavia, particularly the parts of Scandinavia which are inside the Arctic Circle, where there is a period of time where the sun literally disappears. The sun doesn't rise for, I forget how long, obviously it depends where you are in the Arctic Circle, but there's a period of time where the sun simply doesn't rise, and it doesn't start rising again until the new year. And when we speak of the return of the sun and a celebration such as the summer solstice, and we talk about the re-empowering sun or the return of the sun, for those in the region of the Arctic Circle, it was very literal. The sun literally disappeared. It wasn't seen. Whereas in England and Wales and, Germania or Germania, the sun never disappears. In Britain, the only time the sun disappears is when it's behind the clouds, which does happen quite often.
Right.
So so I think there's a different understanding of what the return of the sun actually entails, depending on where you are in the world geographically. So, yeah, I couldn't agree with you more there about that conclusion. And I think my wife and I are currently preparing to be planting lots of vegetables, lots of crops for the season ahead. And where we are, we now live in North Wales. We reference maps which tell us historically when the last frost is going to be, and the last mm-hmm. frost can be 6 weeks different depending where you are in Britain. If you're in Scotland or if you're in the south of England, or even it can depend, because it depends very much in Britain on the Gulf Stream, so even east to west and things like this, or altitude, very, very regionally you can have a different, very different date for when you would be performing something like the Akabot, the ploughing of the field and beginning to plant crops.
Indeed. And in the Winland region, like I said, we have theismic from British Columbia, about 6 hours north of Vancouver or so, where it's much more of a Scandinavian climate. So they follow more of a Scandinavian thew when it comes to when they hold their holy tides. That said, our folk in Tasmania are on the other side of Midgard. And when we're having our winter solstice, they're having their summer solstice. And so for them, the calendar is flipped a bit. And so the reason I point this out is that it's important to, when you're worshiping the gods and you're holding the holy tides, that you pay attention to the land that you live in, the land sort of the land custom. And that'll guide worship quite a bit. You can still be an Anglo-Saxon heathen on the other side of the world, mm-hmm. right? On two different sides of the world, to the west and to the south, right? You can still do it, right? But you also have to, don't be so rigid that you're not going to allow for reality, right? So if it's Estra and it's the right time to hold Estra and the ground is still frozen, maybe you don't want to hold Estra because Estra really targets the beginning of summer. Or maybe you do, because maybe you're acknowledging that summer isn't all about warm weather, right? It's about solar events and celestial events and the time of the year and the things of the sort, the return of the Pleiades and such. So it really just depends. But yeah, I would always say that heathens today should take into account A, whether they're following a Scandinavian custom and calendar or whether they're following an Anglo-Saxon Germanic custom and calendar. And even once you have decided that, you need to tailor it to the landscape and the land and climate and geography that you live in.
Yeah, indeed. Yeah. I put out a post on Telegram recently from last week where I said that it feels like spring has arrived. You know, we're seeing snowdrops and daffodils here where mm-hmm. I am. And it just feels, you know, when you just get that feeling, the light changes and the land, yes. the kind of mood of the land seems to change. And you sense that. And there is kind of like a sixth sense to it almost. It's not entirely quantifiable, but you just feel that arrival of spring. Yet people were commenting on the post saying, you know, whether they were in America or other parts of Britain or Europe. And they were saying, well, we're still in a foot of snow here, or, you know, we've still got, you know, persistent frosts or no, I'm not seeing any signs of spring yet or things like that. So yeah, it really is regional. And I mm-hmm. think that this is something that, and I think this is a problem with online heathenry, right? Because when you come together online and you liaise with other heathens, there tends to be this kind of unspoken move towards centralization of ideas. Like everyone is trying to agree on one central principle, certain hard and fast dates that things happen. And that wouldn't have been a problem for our, well, not a problem, but that wouldn't have been a factor for our ancestors, because everything is informed by what you can see in the environment around you. You wouldn't have had a clue what was going on 100 miles away.
Indeed.
With the climate or with what people were doing and practicing, all you knew and all that really mattered was the changes that you could see in your immediate environment.
Very well said.
Thank you. All right. Next question. There is, I think, another thing that gets spoken of a lot in, wider Germanic heathenry in Arcetru and things like that is this idea that we have holes in our law, in our tradition, and that we need to look elsewhere to fill those gaps, whether it's to look to the east at the Vedic tradition and, you know, try to kind of recreate holes in our tradition using knowledge that we can derive from the east, or whether it's to look to Native Americans for their more the more shamanic aspect, the more animistic aspect of our tradition. How do you feel about that as a Theurdsman? What is the kind of Theurdish view of this? Do you think that there really are any gaps in our understanding, or do you think that actually no, we've got it all? It's just there to be, either followed, adhered to, or perhaps in a few cases still kind of tied together.
Well, I think that we have gaps in our understanding, for sure, right? We have things that we haven't rediscovered or remembered yet. But there's, as I mentioned before, the gods remember their troph. They remember their thu, right? So nothing's truly lost. Theurdsmen do embrace comparative mythology. A number of us have been influenced by the works of Georges Dumézil. I understand his tripartite divisions don't exactly apply in every circumstance, but as a sort of a generality, as a way of beginning to think about how different god cults from different tribes and groups of people sort of fit together and relate, it's a useful starting place. It is. The Romanian Mircea Eliade has been a great influence upon Theurdish thinking, especially his idea of the myth of eternal return, so that by through our rites and through our rituals and through engaging in poetry and stuff, we step out of profane time and space. We re-enter into sacred time and space, and we participate in these sort of godly ongoings, these sort of myths, the act of creation. When a Theurdish blotra blots a swine or some sort of livestock, and then it's then the animal is unmade. This is very much like the act of creation, of Ymir being slaughtered and the world being made from him, and the world being renewed through the bloating and so forth. I would say one thing that I noticed, especially in the early 2010s in America, was amongst the sort of new Anglo-Saxon heathens at the time, there was almost a Puritan streak. Those who wanted to avoid all non-Anglo-Saxon sources as if they could do that. The thing is, if you try it, if you take that approach, you're going to find that you're left with little more than Bede's writings, Beowulf, and Barrowmound grave goods, right? It's important to remember that Anglo-Saxon heathenry, I guess, not to think of it as a mission or something, but you could argue that it was brought to Britannia in 449 when Hengist and Horsa and their ships arrived in Kent. But then by 597, about 150 years later, you already have Augustine's mission in Kent, right, to set up, you know, become Bishop of Canterbury and such. And then by 686, Caedwalla of Wessex, right, leads his army to the kingdom of the Isle of Wight, slays King Arwald, the last heathen king, even after Penda, and massacres the entire island and then resettles it with Christians. So between 449 and 686, you have official heathenry, official Anglo-Saxon heathenry. That's a span of 237 years, right? Of which a fair portion of that, they were in contact with Christians from the get-go, right? And then, of course, once the Anglo-Saxon missions came in and such, the Roman mission came to the Anglo-Saxons. And then, of course, in 793, you had the Vikings attack Lensfarne, right? And so most of the Anglo-Saxon lore that we have is written after Lensfarne. It's written in the 9th and 11th through the 11th centuries, right? So such sources, as wonderful as they are as likely to describe the Danish or the Norse heathenry of that day as they are to be recalling and hearkening back to the Anglo-Saxon heathenry of the past. Mm. So you can't throw out the Nordic corpus, and you can't, while we should be mindful of etiology, right, of doing with the Eddas what Christians have done with the Bible and so forth, I think it's a great mistake to throw out the Nordic corpus. There are so many things. In one Christian poem, ravens are referred to as Wartchiri, right, which is the choosers of the slain. It's the Old English version of Valkyrie. And we wouldn't even know that if it wasn't for the Nordic corpus. Right. So we can't even so much of what we might assume about the gods or Woden. You see the name Thunr pop up. But if you didn't have the stories of Thor, what would you have? So I would say that we do first and foremost look to our Anglo-Saxon sources. But we don't rule out the Norse sources. But there's a lot we can find in an Anglo-Saxon expression. By trying to find an Anglo-Saxon expression of heathenry, there's a wall that you can dig into. There are law codes. There are penitentials. Penitentials being regulations established by the church so that when you go into a confession and you would say that you sacrificed to idols or you burned grain to the dead for health or you practice some other custom, the church would say, well, this is bad and here's your penance. It's what you must do to have your sin forgiven and so forth. So in the penitentials, quite often, if the church says that something is heathen, then we should take note, right? Now, what we find is that the church has oftentimes misunderstood an ancient heathen through and misrepresented it, but there's still something to be dug into there. There's also wills, there's charters, and there's place names. There's a great deal that you can learn from place names. And of course, also linguistic anthropology, looking at the language, looking at the words that were used, and what they tell us about the ideas that informed those word choices and such. So there is a lot that you can do there as an Anglo-Saxon heathen by digging down and trying to give this Germanic heathenry an Anglo-Saxon expression, absolutely. But we also look towards the Celts, the Slavs, the Baltic peoples, to the Vedic traditions, other Indo-European traditions, to kind of help maybe fill in the gaps a bit, but at least to give us something to experiment with or to consider. And are reconstructing.
Yeah, I mean, clearly from what you've just said, there is no real controversy among thirdsmen about, you know, the cross-pollination of Germanic, wider Germanic ideas. And of course, I certainly don't believe that we could ever really, truly reconstruct Anglo-Saxon heathenry without looking to the Eddas and things like that. But it is, you know, and it, among those who would call themselves Arsa True or just heathen or Odinists or whatever, there doesn't seem to be any controversy about borrowing from pan-Germanic sources either. But there does seem to be some controversy among some about borrowing from, well, non-Germanic, but more specifically non-European sources. So, for example, the Vedic sources. And, you know, I can give an example of something like, you know, the system of the chakras. So the chakras, you know, we have lots of, I know most heathens I know practice yoga, for example. And lots of people use the idea of the chakras, the energy centers throughout the body that comes to us from the East. That's an example of something that, as far as I know, isn't well attested in Germanic law, but from the perspective of someone who's looking for spiritual fulfillment and the spiritualization of matter and things like that, these things do make sense. The idea of the chakras do make sense. So, you know, specifically with regards to that example, what do you, you know, would you and you know, the wider corpus of thirdsmen say about such things as borrowing ideas of you know, the chakras or yoga or things like that from the East?
I don't know how much we borrow, but we certainly look at and consult these things. And, you know, each thadesman has a free right in mind, freedom of conscience. And, you know, we do have thadesmen who practice yoga as well. That's not necessarily part of their thadish practice, but they practice yoga as well, and they find fulfillment in that. You know, I think that when you're looking at, we tend to look at Indo-European sources first and foremost, but we can look broader. I mean, I recently read Eliade's book on shamanism. And of course, shamanism, he discusses the phenomenon, well, what it means, and, you know, what it means in Serbia and in Asia, and what it means maybe in other parts of the world. And so it was interesting for me to begin looking at non-Indo-European traditions as well and to find some of the similarities. I mean, there are similarities between Indo-European religion and Tengriism, you know, practiced by the Mongols and such. There's a world tree, seems to be, you know, a hell and a heaven, things of the sort. And there are some ideas. I mean, Joseph Campbell points to some sort of universal myths, you know, the hero's journey and things of the sort that are common just because of our humanity. But we certainly look at everything. I mean, you have to look at, you know, Danish belief sometimes is described as a Wodenic cult. I don't know if that's fair to say. But certainly Woden was there at our founding, and we often seek his inspiration. Woden is a wanderer, and Woden doesn't turn away knowledge mm-hmm. simply because it's not pure, right? Because it's not of a particular pedigree. Woden finds wisdom where he can. Mm-hmm. And so I think what you find is statesmen tend to be very broad-minded. We tend to be very Germanic and Anglo-Saxon in our expression of Thu, right? And what we're hearkening back to, but we tend to be very broad-minded, well-read. We look at a great deal of other things, other traditions and such, and we learn what we can.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, that very much reflects my own view on things as well, particularly with regards to Woden, you know, being a wanderer and a seeker and a learner. And I think that well, there is no better mindset to adopt, I would say, than that of the High One.
Indeed.
Yeah. So lastly, I wondered if you you know, if we could maybe step a little bit into the modern era, more so than we have for the most of this conversation. And you know, I'm a great believer, and I strongly promote in this podcast, you know, it is labeled as a heathen podcast, but regularly, you know, listeners will find that I am discussing somewhat current events, really. And that's because I strongly believe that this is a living tradition and that we need to apply the philosophies of our ancestors to our current situation. So there's obviously been a lot going on over the last few years. A lot's been happening in the world. And, you know, those who may look at Theurdish belief, at Theurdish groups such as yours, the Winland Rishe and things, may see a group who are on the surface of things reliving a certain period of history. Of course, we know that's not true, and we've discussed that over the course of this conversation. But people might think that you're almost isolating yourselves from what's happening in the modern age. But I just wanted to see if you had any thoughts on what's happening in these current times. You know, there's been a huge amount of social upheaval over the last few years. What do you feel that Theurdish belief has to offer in the face of this upheaval? You know, have there, you know, been any kind of, because I see a lot of lost men and women these days. And that one of the main reasons I started the Fergan podcast was because I started to see a lot of people questioning what's happening in the world. And a lot of them were turning to Christianity because they, all of a sudden they realized that, you know, we are living, well, as they would view it, we are living in a time of evil, they would say. And, you know, no longer can that be denied. So they're turning back to where the source of goodness, which, you know, in our modern Western societies, we're taught to believe is Jesus Christ. And my response to that has been to try to let people know, people who are disenchanted with the modern age and particularly with what's happened over the last few years, just to make sure that they know that actually there is another option for them, one that is more befitting of their ancestry and one that offers just as much respite, just as many answers, just as much comfort, I would say, in some ways, as Christianity does. It certainly does for me. So, you know, what would your response to that be? What do you think Theurdish belief has to offer in this in these modern times?
So I think that you have picked up on something that others have noticed, and that's statesmen don't often publicly comment on current events or the woes that afflict our world. There are reasons for that, largely because statesmen tend to be focused on the tradition of our forelders. So you might think of Theurdish Thu as being the base of the Erdmannssul, of Yggdrasil, right? And the roots of it reach down into the hidden world of our forelders, our ancestors, and we draw forth those traditions up into that trunk. And then the leaves and branches go out and they reach into the heavens and draw the inspiration from the gods. And we're always there at the Axis Mundi, at the Erdmannssul, at Yggdrasil, in the center of things. Not politically centrist, right? But Thu is what it is. You know, these traditions are eternal, right? And they have deep roots and they reach up to the heavens. And so what we find is that the world around us changes, but our Thu doesn't. What our ancestors did from time immemorial doesn't change. And so back in the 80s and 90s, statesmen may have looked a bit on the left from outsiders. But that's because the Overton window had shifted so far to the right. Right. Mm. Sort of the satanic panic, we're accused of being devil worshippers and things of the sort.
Yes.
But then now, really since the 2010s, when the Overton window shifted to the left, we tend to be mistaken for being on the right. Right. So we get called all the nasty names they call people on the right. But the truth of the matter is we follow the custom of our forelders, and that doesn't change. And so regardless of what moral panic is going on at the time, statesmen remain the same. That doesn't mean that we don't have thoughts and opinions or discuss these things amongst ourselves. But when we engage the general public about it, we try to speak broadly and we try to relate it to concepts of luck, right? And to Thu and to the realness of the gods. And so I would like to, you know, listening to your podcast, I agree with a great many of concerns that you and your guest have, probably all of them, right? And I think that you have particularly pointed out a number of economic and cultural trends that are quite, you know, disconcerting. And we Theurdish, of course, naturally share that perspective as well. But I think that one thing that if I were to maybe say, what is the root of the evil of this age? I would say it comes down to a sickness of storytelling. So I like the quote from Martin Scholl, a countryman of yours, from his book, Courting the Wild Twin. He said that the business of stories is not enchantment. The business of stories is not escape. The business of stories is waking up. And I think it's no coincidence that we've referred to the revival of heathendom since the 70s as the reawakening, right? The stories these days, they're sickly stories. They're a sleep thorn. They're a draught or a drink of forgetfulness. They're often anti-heroic. They often promote a cult of victimhood. They're subversive, both culturally and morally. And they're designed to instill despair. So, and you can see this in modern cinema. There was, for example, there's a series of novels by a George R. R. Martin fellow. And I think they were made into a show for HBO, and Game of Thrones, I think is what it was called. And I watched a few episodes of it, but there was a tendency to kill off a character, to subvert the heroic arc, right? Yes. And to unexpectedly kill off someone. And what this does is it instills despair. These aren't heroic stories, and narratives are extremely important to us. Harkening back to our earlier part of our conversation when I talked about how the English forgot their Anglo-Saxonness and how we as Americans forgot our English and Britishness, right? The stories that we tell about ourselves and the stories we don't tell about ourselves, they matter. And one thing that we as statesmen have learned over the years is that if we don't tell our own stories, right, we don't tell our own story, others will tell our story for us. And we also have to be mindful of the stories that we listen to, that we hear, that we absorb, that we take in. Because, like I said, they tend to be anti-heroic and subversive and to instill despair. And I would say that for this reason, Thadesmen tend to avoid Hollyweird as much as possible. They tend to avoid the HBO, Netflix, things of the sort. They may subscribe from time to time because there's something in particular they want to watch or to listen to. I recently myself watched a series on Netflix about the rise of the Ottoman Empire, which I thought was fascinating. It was a sort of a docudrama. So there is a place for that. We do have televisions, but most of us probably don't have cable, right? Mm-hmm. And we're very careful about what we let our children watch, because even the cartoons these days are designed to not push, to not instill virtue, to not instill custom, not instill cultural understanding, but to be subversive and to instill confusion. And so we're very careful with that. And one of our solutions we have to this is that Thadesmen are great believers in the power of poetry. You know, the shope of yore, the scold of yore could make a man for eternity, right? He could affect your refrain, your reputation in such a way. It was worse than physical violence. You know, physical violence, a man might hit you and you might heal, right? But if a shope writes a lay about you that depicts you in a bad way, that could be remembered for hundreds of years, right? Poetry is the language of myth, right? Thadesmen tend to look at myth not so much as theological reasoning, but as poetic grammar. And we have several traditions surrounding poetry and storytelling because, you know, poetry is part of the way we tell our storytelling. And even in your short story recently, Fire in the White Stone, the way you alliterate it, I described it as poetic prose, right? So you're tapping into that. We have a tradition of shopcraft. So the bard in the hall playing upon the harp and telling stories and recounting tales of old. For us, the rite of symbol may be more formal than it is elsewhere, but symbol is a form of storytelling. It's a way of casting a spell, right? So we begin, we have a round, and we tell tales of the gods, right? And this draws the gods to us. And then we recount heroic tales of yore, right? And we then call our heroic ancestors to us. And then we make yelps, we make brags, we make bayets and boast of what we're going to do. We tell tales of our own deeds even, right? And that truly is the power of it there. It's just the storytelling, going back from the gods to our ancestors, and then telling the story of our own time. Also, we perceive ritual as a form of storytelling. I mentioned Eliade's myth of eternal return, how we enter into sacred time and sacred space through ritual. And it's how we participate in those myths. So as far as some of the things that we have to offer, with the way we, and these are things that other heathens can discover too, even outside of Thetish belief, if they're earnest, they earnestly go about it. We have to offer a way to step out of this profane time and space and to enter into the timelessness of myth, to live in that. We have a blotrhad, a priesthood, a formal seminary called the Wevethane Guild. We have rites and rituals that we have practiced with and developed and refined for nearly 50 years. Some of these are old heathen rites that we've reconstructed, and some of them are new poetic works based off that, that have grown out from that. We've also begun establishing holy groves and halls. Matter of fact, Ravenshu in British Columbia will be raising a hall, I think, sometime next year, and I'll be going out to help with the work on that.
Wonderful. Yeah.
So I think the greatest thing that Thetish belief has to offer its Thetismen is a way to encounter the gods, a way to encounter their ancestors, a way to experience the holy. So, and I think that, like I said, I think if I were to look at the root of the evil of the age in which we live, I think it comes down to storytelling. And I think one of the things that we have to offer are good stories, the right kind of stories, eternal stories.
Yeah, indeed. And what greater purpose can religion serve other than to give people something timeless that stands against whatever might batter it from without, a haven as such, but not a place to escape to, but a place where everything makes sense, where everything,
yes.
everything appears the same as it would have done to our ancestors, where there is no confusion about the way that society or existence should be experienced.
Well, and I think you got a good point there. It's not about escaping. We still have to live in this world, in this host society, but it's about finding a place where you can have true frith, security of being amongst one's own kind, being amongst one's folk, right? Mm. And being in fellowship with the gods again, and in fellowship with the dead, with your ancestors.
Yeah.
But we still have to come out of that. But this renews us. It strengthens us.
Yes.
And allows us to then go forth back into our day-to-day lives, where we do have to deal with things such as all the politics surrounding the pandemic lockdowns. We have to deal with the very dark and sinister visions put forth by the World Economic Forum. We have to deal with the rise of authoritarianism in the world today, which is a real... So it's interesting that, we believe in sacral kingship, and for us to be anti-authoritarian is not a contradiction, because sacral kingship, or the Old English and Germanic model of Königshippe, is not authoritarian. It's based upon tradition and upholding tradition as opposed to enforcing one's will. Like I said, I've listened to your podcast episodes, and I agree wholeheartedly with a great deal of what has been said, and we see those problems too.
But it's just that you don't bring them into the rites themselves, which is perfectly exactly. Understandable. Yeah, because
our work is to establish God cults and to create culture. Now, there's a cultural war going on, right? And Thetismen are quite capable of fighting in a cultural war, but we're also in a unique position because of our history, because of our weird and the orlay we have to create culture. And you've got to have a culture. And to recreate a culture and to renew a culture worth fighting for. One of your guests not long ago, an American chap, was talking about the family and how we now associate the nuclear family with the family, but it initially before it was like a clan, right? The extended
Dave
family.
Dave Martell, I believe, yeah.
Yeah, was the family. And so, what that pointed out to me, and it's something that we've observed as well, is that you have to have something worth fighting for. And it can't just be the nuclear family. It's got to be true family, right?
Yes.
And so for us, it's not just about fighting for culture as we had it in the 1990s or 1980s. It's got to be, we've got to renew our true culture. We've got to rekindle those embers and to have something truly worth carrying forward. And so I think that's the great work that Daidsman can do. But yes, we find all this nonsense to be despicable, indeed. But we're in a position where we have these works that we can then offer the rest of the heathen community, while others tend to be out there on the forefront of the culture war. And like I said, we can do that too. But we tend to see ourselves as creators or recreators or kindlers of culture.
And that's something that I'm finding myself moving more and more towards. My own personal belief is that there is no political solution to the problems that we face today.
There's not.
And this is something that I've believed for years, but I think it's a realization that many people are having now. And I welcome that, because what I'm seeing is a lot of people now, their real fight now is in creating culture or preserving meaningful culture. And what you described there about the perversion of storytelling, what's happened with that, and your example of George R.R. Martin, I think his name is a very, very good one, because he actually, I believe, he said in interviews that he set out with the specific goal of smashing those traditional archetypal ways of telling stories, of there being some kind of uncertainty as to whether a character is really good or bad. The fact that, as you mentioned, heroic characters are killed off unexpectedly and early on in stories and things like that. And yes, I think that is in many ways that does describe the problems that we're facing. And when I'm struggling to think of examples of the sort of tyranny that's encroaching upon the world that isn't there because of the perversion of storytelling, because of the upending of traditional mythological archetypes. And as you alluded to, myth is should be seen as eternal truth, really. And the reason that it is eternal truth is because it upholds the law. Myth is there. Myth and poetry are there to uphold the law. They do that by reminding each and every generation what the true natural law of their society and community is and should be. And if someone comes along in a certain generation in a certain time and starts telling stories which completely defy the original message and morale of those timeless myths, then it's going to cause a change of behavior within society, and worse still, it's going to cause an immense confusion. And that's what we live in now, and it's a time of confusion. And what I see, what you mentioned there, it seems to me that you are as concerned about exposure to the wrong things as you are about ensuring that people are exposed to the right things. So I think food is a good example. It's a nutrition, because most people believe that we become unhealthy through not eating enough of the right things. Very few people realize that we also become healthy through eating too much of the wrong things. It's not just about what you abstain from. It's about what you consume that is toxic as well. And, you put that in a cultural context. So it's about learning the true traditions and law of our society, the healthy ones, whilst also making sure that we limit our exposure to the unhealthy ones, right?
Indeed. And, it's wonderful that you mentioned sort of the food analogy. A number of Thadesmen have their own farms, right? So Hravenshire Thade has its own farm, raises its livestock, grows its own grain. You also have a sheep farm in Appledore Hall in Tasmania. We in the Old Reacher have a Thade garden that we have a fairly large lot here that people take time and they work in. But eating organic food, it's not a matter of it being simply kosher or something for us where we have to follow this, right? But we're being more mindful about what we put in our bodies. Right. And it's not just a matter of not putting evil things in. We must put good and wholesome things in. And that's also the mind and the heart, too. And so storytelling speaks to the mind and to the heart. And we have to be careful, because we the number of stories that you could find on Netflix or on HBO or whatever cable service you might use today, right, are innumerable. Thousands of stories, right? And very few of them have anything edifying to offer, right? Mm. They will weaken you. They will lead you away. And it's interesting, too, the way they fetishize these. And they talk about canon. So if there's a series of stories, they talk about the canon for those as if it's some sort of religious doctrine, right? And that's quite fascinating that they, you know, fiction now is taking the place of sacred stories, which are true. And I mean, it's not taking the place, it's being used as a poor substitute, right? It's margarine rather than nourishing butter. So
yes. Well, that's an equally good analogy that you make there. But yes, I think we're up to about, over 2 hours now. And although there are many other things that I could ask you about, and I did have suggestions because we have a private Fergan chat group on Telegram for patrons. And I always ask for input from the members there for questions I should ask. And some of them have had kind of last minute offered some very good suggestions, but they're big subjects that we can't possibly get into in any meaningful way now. So, you know, maybe somewhere down the line, if Thorbecht has time, we can do a part two of this. There may be other things we can find to discuss.
I love that. I love that. And also I'd offer, I know that Alfred Clavard I've mentioned him and you've mentioned his music, Alfred Avery and such. I know that he would probably be delighted to come on as well if you ever want to discuss theater shukcraft and storytelling and poetry and so forth.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Oh, that's good to know. I'll definitely be extending an invitation to him.
Excellent.
So where can people find out about your work, your books? Maybe you'd like to mention some of the books that you've written that people can look up and the best places for them to purchase them if they're interested, and which websites are the best sources of information for about yourself and Theurdish belief in general. Where are you most active?
Sure. So we have some websites. So wienlandriche.org. So Wienland, Wienland. And the Riche is spelled the same way the word rice is spelled, R-I-C-E. So wienlandriche.org. And from there, one can find links to all the other theids and halls and leids in the Wienlandriche, such as the Old Riche Theid. We also have Hadegild books, so Holy Guild books. And you can find a link there as well, but it's haliggyld.org. And that's where a number of my works, also some of Garmin Lord's classic works, have been reprinted, such as the Usita Handbook, and then a collection of some of his unpublished materials we put out called From the Gift Stool. So those are, if one wants to have an understanding of Theurdish belief and how it was founded, and some of the early perspective Theidsmen have, I would recommend those two works by Garmin Clavard. Also, my own works are published there. I have a hardbound of Ghost and God Poles, Theurdish essays pertaining to the reconstruction of Saxon heathen belief, both old and Anglo. And also To Hold the Holy Tides, a collection of articles on the Anglo-Saxon heathen ritual year, its keeping, its custom. And those two are the ones that I get the most feedback on. They're the ones that people seem to enjoy the most. Also have a book on Old Saxon Gelders written in the Old Saxon, the continental North German tongue, as well as an Old English Gelder book. So Gelders and Bades written to the gods in the Old English tongue, that's available there. One of the books that's a collection of essays about the ancient Germanic priesthood called In Hallowed Groves is something that we use in the Wavertane Guild. Also, I have a book on reckoning, how I reckon the solar lunar calendar by the sun, the stars, the moon, which is more of a reference guide. And then, of course, Spellstow. So Spellstow is the quarterly magazine that Wienlandriche puts out. SPELLSTOW.org. And people can subscribe for a free PDF, or they can purchase printed copies as well. It tends to run somewhere between 35 and 70 pages, depending on the issue and the content we have. It contains writings from a number of different Theurdish authors. And it's also the only place to get up to date current news as to the ongoings and happenings within the Wheeland Reacher. So
excellent. Right. Well, I'll make sure to put all of those links in the podcast description in the text, because there's quite a lot there, and I'm going to personally be on a mission to consume all of these books and all of this content as much as I can. One of my greatest frustrations in life is not having enough time to read. I know that there are people out there who do find a lot of time and can, you know, might wonder, but you know, I'm a family man with three young children. I work quite long hours. I do the Fergan, and I'm homesteading at the same time. So, yeah, time is rare for reading, but I hope to rectify that in the future. And I always make sure to uphold that. So, anyway, thank you very much, Thorbeck. It's been wonderful speaking with you again. And let's stay in touch. And I hope that all of the listeners those who have and haven't heard of the Theodish belief and the Wheeland Reacher and Thorbecht, that you're now more enlightened than you were two and a bit hours ago. So Thorbecht, is there any final things that you wanted to say before we close this episode?
Just that thank you for inviting me and asking me to come on this. It was a true honor. I tremendously enjoyed the first conversation you and I had a few weeks ago, and I've enjoyed this one as well. I look forward to you know, if you want to have me back on again to answer some of those questions, I'd be delighted to.
Yes.
Yeah. And I'll be sure to send you a copy of Alfred's Watling Street. And if you email me your mailing address as well, I'll see to it. Some of these other Theodish works that you don't have, I'll send you copies.
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you, Thorbecht. We'll be in touch. And to all the listeners, thank you again for listening to the Fergan podcast. And please, share this around. I think there are still quite a few people out there who would find some worth in these episodes, particularly ones like this with, high quality guests that may not know about the Fergan podcast. So if they don't, please let them know that it exists. And let's help to further the ideas of heathenry worldwide. Now, I'm sure that you've all been waiting with bated breath for the answer to our previous riddle. And I mentioned in the last episode that the answer to the riddle of episode number 26, I thought it might be the first overtly non-heathen riddle that we've really come across. And it is indeed. The answer to that one is book, but specifically a copy of the Gospels, so a religious book. And as these riddles were written down in the time in the post-Christian era, I think we can safely say that it was referring to, you know, a copy of the Bible or the Gospels. You know, an enemy ended my life, deprived me of my physical strength, then he dipped me in water and drew me out again. So I think this is talking about the binding of the book in leather. Put me in the sun where I soon shed all my hair. This is to do with the tanning the hide, tanning the leather to create a leather-bound book. And then, sprinkling meaningful marks. Swallowed more wood dye. Wood dye travelled over me, leaving black tracks. This is the writing of the words. Then a man bound me. He stretched skin over me and adorned me. These glorious adornments bring fame far and wide to the protector of men. I think there it's referring to Christ, probably, not to the pains of hell. If only the sons of men would make use of me, they would be the safer and the more victorious. I think there it's talking about how the Bible or the Gospels bring strength to men, or this was certainly the belief at the time that this riddle was composed. So nevertheless, it's a great riddle. I think it's particularly poetic, that one, quite evocative. So riddle number 27 for this episode is as follows. Favoured by men, I am found far and wide, taken from woods and the heights of the town, from high and from low. During each day, Corbiculus brought me through the bright sky, skillfully home to a safe shelter. Soon after that, I was taken by men and bathed in a tub. Now I bind and I chasten them, and cast a young man at once to the ground, and sometimes an old one too. He who struggles against my strength, he who dares grapple with me, discovers immediately that he will hit the hard floor with his back if he persists with such stupidity. Deprived of his strength and strangely loquacious, he's a nincompoop who rules neither his mind nor his hands nor his feet. Now ask me, my friends, who knocks young men stupid, and as his slaves binds them in broad, waking daylight? Yes, ask me my name. Thank you all once again, as always, for listening to the Fergen podcast. Please visit fyrgen.com for all the past episodes, for ways to support this endeavor, for merchandise even. There are some a few items left, not many now, but there's still some stuff left. And yeah, there's ways of contacting me on there if you have cause to do so. And yeah, please share this about and let others know that it exists. And as I said earlier, hopefully we can spread the word of heathendom to those who need to hear it. Thank you all. I'll speak to you in the next episode.